יש תרגום לעברית עם יונת, מישהו שרוצה. אני אשמח עם אלה ששוכבים, עושה כזה קצת מאמץ לשבת. אפילו אם יש קיר, אפשר לשען, לשען על קיר, זה בסדר. אחרת אני עצמי שוכב. למה לא? אם זה האנרגיה, אז אני אשתתף ואני שוכב גם. Okay, the title tonight is a quote from the Buddha that said, practice as if your hair is on fire. I would like to add a question mark. He was making a statement, but I will add a question mark to this. Yeah. Shukma?
H-A-R-E?
No. So we come to retreat for a load of reasons. Curiosity, maybe we've got headache we want to treat, maybe we've got some stress, maybe we heard it's great, or we heard it's a major challenge and we want to beat it. It's amazing actually the number of people who are now, you know, great Dharma teachers, heading monasteries and so on, and if you ask them how they started, they simply said, oh, I had a migraine headache and I went into the local monastery to say, do you have a treatment? And the monk there said, well, sit down and sit down, stop, and we'll sort you out. So, and then they started from there and then moved on to become great spiritual teachers. So it's completely legitimate to kind of come with this initial intention, and then the intention changes as you move forward. Something happens to change the goals, the goalposts, right? And the goalposts shift as every time you try and score a goal, the goal gets further away. But the whole intention shifts as you get deeper, and that's really the a kind of a theme of this talk. Actually, there's loads of themes in this talk, so if you feel a bit that there's too many themes, then that's the nature of Teva Hadvarim, okay? But we may find that we come into a retreat with rather simple, you know, I've got a headache, I've got to deal with it, I've got a tummy ache, I've got this, and slowly we learn during the retreat that we're talking about transformation of the self, and maybe we actually experience it. Maybe we experience something that we haven't really experienced about ourselves before, and we realize, well, it's not just a stress in the body that that this is doing. There's something existential about what we're doing here. And someone, for example, came to me during the retreat and said that they haven't been as happy for 5 years. They remember it's 5 years they haven't experienced happiness like they experienced here. So clearly, you know, this is not just dealing with stress in the back. This is something existential, and we have to address that. In some way, we are building powers. I know that sounds a bit sort of masculine, power, you know, go to the cheder kosher called Eindor, go to the, and do some exercise and build powers, muscles, spiritual muscles, but muscles. But the Buddha actually did talk about powers, and I think it's right. If we take away a little bit the masculine meaning of this, for example, faith and trust is a power. It's a power. It helps us navigate through the difficult waters of life. Therefore, it's a power. It helps us immediately. It helps us in every challenge that we face, whether it's someone cutting us off in where we're driving and we get angry, but then suddenly there's a sense, trust and faith in the world. We don't need to get angry at this time. It's not worth it. Surrender is a power. We sometimes think, well, it's a negative thing, it's a passive thing. No, we are gaining the power to surrender to what we can't control. It's giving us actually more power to know how to surrender when surrender is needed, rather than, as Simi was saying, give up the struggle. We don't need to struggle all our life against ourselves or against things that don't need struggling. So surrender can be a power. So clearly we are developing powers, some of which we don't know yet. We don't even know they're inside us. Just the fact that we're sitting 45 minutes, don't take it lightly. It's quite a serious thing. We sit 45 minutes. Never mind that the mind is going bananas, bent or straight. The fact that we sit dealing with our stuff for 45 minutes, who can do it? How many people in this country of 6 million souls can sit 45 minutes totally silent, steady like a rock, and meet their stuff? Not so many. So we're doing something that is powerful and developing, in this case, steadiness, ability to be with ourselves without too much fear and alarm, ability to be steady and sit quiet and see life as it comes. This is not a small thing. And life can feel different. The transformation happens when we're challenged, or should we say the transformation is seen by ourselves more when we're challenged. We might not notice now change, but we might well notice it when we're out in the world facing a challenge that tests us. And then we may well notice it. In one of my groups today, the question came up, how do I respond to an attack of somebody, a verbal attack, without criticism and judgment? Surely criticism and judgment are needed in situations of life in order to tell somebody don't do what you're doing, or to correct them, or to say something is harmful, damaging or stupid. I want to be critical. And we had a discussion in the group about it, which was very fruitful. And it's an example of the tools that we're developing here, how we confront a situation like that in our daily life. For example, the fact that we can sit steady here means that we can stand steady there. Standing steady means standing in front of challenge, such as someone shouting at us. We might be able to find that we can stand on our ground. So right away we see the Dharma is not making us collapse, weak, spiritual, you say fold up, mukalep, is it, or how you say it? Mukupal, that's the word, yeah. The Dharma is not doing that. And you look at people who are been practicing a long time, they're the ones that go into the Palestinian territories and try and make peace, or into the into Aza, the Hitna Kut, and try and help it to happen without violence. It helps us to sit here with our stuff, will help us to stand our ground with courage in daily life, partly because we feel more empty, partly because we feel less busy with ourself. If we feel less busy with ourself, we have less self to defend. There's less me that needs all the time defending. So we need to pay less attention, we need to be less busy with our guard, shirion, all the time. Most of the time in life people are very busy with the shirion, defending, they mustn't hurt me, arguing with everybody, fighting with everybody, and making sure that the world is there. And we don't need to do that, because the shirion, the protection, is inside. Because we sit here quietly, steady, and we feel here. That's our protection. Nothing can move us. We're like a rock. So we're learning that slowly, slowly. It may not be one retreat, but we're learning, for example, steadiness. If we are steady, we can then stand, and wisdom is another tool we're using. We can then stand our ground more freely and answer this person or this situation in the way it needs, rather than be reactive, defensive, automatic, which usually means shouting back. We may want to shout. Maybe there needs more volume in our voice. Maybe. But not automatic. To stand ground, to be steady, and to wisely express something, it works. One Dharma teacher gave a story about how she was attacked in Zurich, I think. Someone came to rob her with a knife as she was walking in the street, and she felt a person holding her with a knife on her neck, saying, "Give me your bag." And she turned around to the person and said, "Is that really necessary?" And it worked, and the person dropped the knife and said, "You're crazy." We don't need to put someone down in order to build ourselves up. We don't need, and the Buddha said that, there is no need to put anyone down or to build them up or to put ourselves down or to build ourselves up relative to others. No need. Why? Two reasons I said. Firstly, we sit steady. We are steady. And secondly, we're more empty, taking ourselves less seriously. We don't need to put ourselves up more than others, or put ourselves down, or put others up or down. So in this argument with somebody, we don't need to put them down. We don't need to be critical, because that's about the person. That's a habit of mind of us that we can work with. Critical mind is a habit of mind. Just keeps coming up. So we don't need to be critical of others in order to say something that helps in that situation. Because we don't need to address the person, put them down, criticize them, make them feel small. We need to address the situation in the present moment. There's a freedom in that. The situation in the present moment asks us for a strong statement, such as no. The offie. In that moment, we are free enough in the present to say no. We don't need to be critical in order to do that, because that's judging the person. It doesn't help. We can be compassionate to the person instead and still say no. Like with a child that wants the chocolate, 10th chocolate of the day, and you know that it's going crazy. One of my grandchildren says, "I know it's not good for me, I know it makes me go wah, but I do want another chocolate." Very sweet. If 5 years old. So, and finally, another tool that we're learning that I want to just give as an example in this situation, this is mindfulness. And mindfulness is a major, major tool for us, a major power. Carries us all the way through our life. Our mindfulness will be able to tell us what this person is really saying when they're shouting at us. What's really going on with them? Why they're like that? And maybe that will bring compassion, because we see their suffering, and that's why they can't help it. They can't help shouting, or they can't help attacking, or they can't help their aggression or their stupidity. So mindfulness will help us in such a situation, mindful of ourselves, mindful of the other. And so that's another of the tools that we're learning. But we'll talk more tomorrow about these tools and how they help us in our daily life, and there'll be a whole talk about that tomorrow. But I do want to go on from there. I want to take the opportunity to go further. That we're really not here just to develop extra powers and potentials. Although wonderful that is, it is wonderful, but there is more than that. And we have to ask ourselves, I don't know if you know the word samsara, which means the kind of general mess that we live in, the kind of what I said before about the hamster going round in the wheel, and the sense of our life being like that, and our life being on the automatic pilot, tayas automati, is the sense of samsara. It's the difficulty we experience in life, which we're born into, the life we cannot control. And what these potentials can do for us, these abilities, is actually make us live a bit happier in a prison. But samsara is a kind of a prison, so it's a little bit like getting a high quality samsara, if you like, is it an expression that's been going around, high quality samsara. Yeah, I mean, it's fine. I don't want to put it down. And for many, this is what the whole purpose is. There's, you know, a lot of people using Dharma tools in the professions. I don't have time to talk about it, but there's a lot of work on, for example, mindfulness in therapy, in medicine, in hospitals, with the death and the dying, and so on. Many of the Dharma tools that I talked about are actually coming into Western society and are being used in all kinds of contexts for helping people live a better life. And so I really don't want to put it down, it's vital. But I do want to go a bit further. And I think that we can go further than just limit ourselves to high quality samsara, to having more ease and joy in ordinary life. In the end, the Dharma is a spiritual journey. So I want to address a little bit, what does that mean, a spiritual journey? What's involved in a spiritual journey? What is a spiritual path, actually? The Buddhist path is a path. It's very well defined through thousands of pages of texts and talks and instructions. There is paths laid out, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, quite systematically. So there's a lot of structure in the Buddhist path, and we are benefiting from it right now in this retreat. There is a lot of non-structure as well, which I'll talk about in a minute. But I just want to give you an example of a text that talks about path. The text says, how does one go on this journey? You start with some faith and interest. This leads you to go to a teacher. For us, faith and interest in the West is generally reading books. That's where we start, for most of us. Faith and interest leads a little bit of curiosity, and we read books. But it's not enough. We can't do it all by sitting at home in the armchair reading a book. The next stage is a teacher. Now, in the West, we don't have, and in, particularly in the Dharma, we don't have, or should we say, not all the Dharma, but the Vipassana Dharma and many other Dharma journeys or vehicles, we don't have a guru tradition. So it's not like that we go to one teacher and surrender totally to whatever the teacher says we do exactly, and we stay with this teacher all the time. In the West, we go to many teachers. This is the way it is. This is our Western culture. It's okay. Anyway, the Dharma fits itself into every culture. And if the Western culture is like that, it fits itself into that. And if you're in the East, in a traditional Eastern culture, you might go to one guru and stay with them until you decide that you want to be on your own. But teacher, and then you listen. This is what the text says: listening, absorbing, accepting, and surrendering a bit, surrendering your judgment, giving some faith. But interestingly enough, the text says with reflection. This is not blind faith and not blind surrender. It's faith and acceptance of a path with reflection, wisdom, and checking things out, looking at things carefully. From the acceptance comes energy and motivation, energy and determination. You listen, you're inspired, and from there arises this energy and motivation without which you cannot practice. From the energy and determination, you begin to practice, but you don't know exactly how to practice, so you try this and you try that. There is a search involved in practice itself. What is better for me? What is the right fine-tuning? You know, the navet. This is better. Concentration is a better path. Mindfulness is a better path for me. I'll do it like this, I'll do it like that. There is some... And then practice, followed by realization, and practice and more realization, and practice and more realization. And the final step, and this is a very beautiful phrase from the text that says, realizes the ultimate truth with the body. Very nice, it's very Buddhist in a way. Not theoretically up there somewhere in conceptual high... Within the body, realizing the ultimate truth. Nirvana realized through the body. It's very interesting that the body is... we're born into it, and that's our window into reality. There are many ways that the Dharma path is defined and described, and what's important for us is that ordinary life, not just retreats, but ordinary life becomes our spiritual practice. That there's less and less difference between retreat and a monastery and the street. They gradually come together. There's less and less privilege or specialness about meditation, sitting quietly, formal practice, and practice of mindfulness as we walk down Rehov Dizengoff. Less and less that they come together, like the Zen story. Students asked a Zen master, what's the highest thing that you can do? He said, sitting meditation. The student said, but master, you're never sitting. You're doing the cheshbonot, the accounts, you're welcoming people, you're digging the garden, you're cutting the vegetables, you're cleaning like everybody. You don't sit. He said, yes, it's true. I welcome the guests, I do the cheshbonot, the accounts, I dig in the garden, I clean, I cut vegetables, but I never stop sitting. It's, the two come together, and it's important because otherwise our meditation is the only place, and we restrict our spiritual journey to very small bits of our life, and then it's like we forget it and we go and struggle in life, and then we have to, oh, I must go on a retreat, I lost everything, and then it starts, the retreat finishes, we go back to life, and then somehow we finish our practice, we think life is not a place I can practice at all, and so on. We'll deal with that tomorrow, but it is important to emphasize it right now as well. But the main thing, the main issue, the thread that carries us forward on the spiritual life is not experiences, is not ecstasies, is not special experiences of joy or sadness or anything. It is intention. The intention is the thread that carries us through day by day and will convert ordinary life into our monastery. The intention. And if you think about it, the intention, which you can say in a number of ways, it can be described as refuge. Okay, we talked about that at the beginning. Refuge meaning miflat. Not miflat in the house and the mashkanta and the car and the avodah, but the work. The miflat, the shelter, the refuge in the spiritual path itself, in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha if you're a Buddhist. But refuge in some other path if you're not a Buddhist. It's okay, but the refuge is needed. Otherwise, you can't. It's very hard to remember to be there with the spiritual life in the middle of Dizengoff. The intention is what carries you through, not the experiences. And experiences can change. You can have flat, you know, intention hitkavnuyot, hitkavnut. You can have a flat time or a dramatic, you know, dramatic time. Somebody asked the question, what is karma? And I just want in a few words, I can't again talk about it at length, but in a few words I just want to mention karma, because karma is a quite a helpful Eastern concept or understanding. It's more than a concept, in a way of life, that helps us understand why we can't control things. Why at one minute there's a pain and we sat 5 retreats, finished all our pain, no pain in sitting, and the 6th retreat when I think I'm a good sitter and I'm past all of that Kita Aleph stuff called pain in the back, and then boom, pain in the back, big time. Karma means rules that we don't know about, we can't control, because karma is action. An action, it's more than action, it's creation. It's close to Bria in the Jewish, in Hebrew, creation. It's the way the world keeps going, creating itself more again and again and again. But it's vast and it's huge, and it's all the influences, if you think about it, all the influences, it takes the whole universe to make this moment. This moment right now takes the whole universe to be what it is, to make this moment what it is. The whole, it's like also the butterfly effect, you know, the butterfly effect? A butterfly in the Amazon flapping its wings means a storm in Singapore. It's the influences and the things that keep samsara rolling, keep. So karma is cause and effect big time. The net the interaction, the huge net of cause and effect, which we are way beyond us to understand and predict. Anybody that says to you, like the Tibetans, somebody say, oh, he is a cripple in a wheelchair in this life because he did something to somebody in somebody's back in the previous life, doesn't work like that. I'll just dispute with anyone that had simple view of karma, because karma is vast and we cannot, it doesn't have those kind of simple rules, one to one cause and effect. It doesn't have that. But we know, if we keep on with our spiritual life, blessings happen. It's not exactly that flowers are falling from the sky, although they sometimes do. Maybe here, at least in spring, you come to Ain Dor and you'll see flowers falling from the sky. But we feel blessed, and blessings happen to us because something is happening to our karma in a way we don't understand. Things seem to be working. Things happen differently. And this is quite a traditional view of the spiritual path. If you go to the East, most people who are in spiritual practice, millions of sadhus in the East would say, I am practicing all my life so that my karma will be pure and clean. So it's a model of spiritual life, karma. But we can see it right in this life. We don't have to think about life after life. This life, something happens if we sow seeds that are pure. If we sow fine quality seeds, we're going to get fine quality plants. Some way or other will happen like that. It may not also, because as I say, karma is uncontrollable. We may throw lots and lots of beautiful fine quality seeds and we get knocked over the next day by a bus in Rukhov Diesenburg. Never mind the mindfulness. The seeds may, yeah, or we don't know, but yes, they probably will. Somewhere or other they will, yeah, you're right. Yeah, they will grow anyway, somewhere or other, to somebody or other. It's true. So we're in the reshet, we're in a connectedness, and so that's another model of our spiritual journey. Intention and motivation is a very important. Once I listened to a talk by a Zen master, Narada Roshi, and someone in the audience got up, this is California, and said, well, in the morning I first do Qigong, and then I do Kabbalah meditation, and after that I do a bit of Vipassana, and then I have a cup of coffee, and then I go back and I do asanas, and then I meditate on mantra, and is that good? And Narada Roshi said, straight away, you know, Zen master, just tach, no thinking, he just spontaneously said, it doesn't matter what you do, as long as you do it as if your life depends on it. You understood the back there? Said it a bit fast. Doesn't matter what you do, as long as you do it as if your life depends on it. So in a way, the intention is more important even than the path you choose. It can be there many different paths. And here is the Buddhist phrase, practice as if your hair is on fire, with determination, with intensity. There's a quote that says, Mara, if Mara comes to you, Mara being the sort of Dharma Buddhist version of the Satan, he will always come to you with this statement saying, you have plenty of time, don't worry, tomorrow is good as well, you won't die yet, you've got a long life ahead of you, it's all right, relax, space out. And the text says that if you hear that voice, that's Mara. But the truth is that you can die tomorrow. So get on with it. We once had a Tibetan teacher that for 2 weeks was giving us these incredible descriptions of all the different hell, the Sheol, that are waiting for us if we don't practice. The cold one, the very cold one, the super cold one, the unbelievably cold one, I mean there's so many of them. The metal one, the iron one, and then the hot one, the very hot one, on and on, every day another one. After 2 weeks, now there was 100 Americans in the room, and after 2 weeks of this, someone quietly went up and said, teacher, you know, actually, many of us here are Catholics. And we've been through this since our childhood. Do you think you might switch channels, maybe? So for us, I think the spiritual motivation in Western culture can be a bit more subtle, but also profound, of the kind which is the question, what are we doing with this one precious life, as the poet Mary Oliver asks. What are we doing with this one precious life, this one time only visit to this body? What are we doing? Or what really matters? What's really important? It's that kind of question that brings us, I would say, to motivation in a more balanced way than all the hells of the Catholics or the Tibetans, or even all the fear of Mara and so on. We don't need that. And we're in a culture also. It's very important to remember that the Dharma works within a culture. Can't be any other way. Karma is culture. The Western culture is our karma. It's not someone else's karma, it's ours. So within that, that's where we need to start from. And these kind of questions, I think, fit our culture better. And these questions are, for us, maybe the motivation on a spiritual path rather than just a feeling better kind of path, of high quality samsara kind of path. And we do need some help with this. We may not need a one guru, but we need help. Because there's so much beyond us that it's hard for us to kind of pull ourselves up by our own efforts. It's quite hard. So we need help, and there is help around. We need courage. We need courage when we feel the power of the herd mind, the Eder, the mind of the Eder that says what's important is, I don't know, football, money, job, success, ambition, that's what's important. And that voice is very, very strong, and all of us believe it, more or less. We shouldn't underestimate it. And then we find ourselves quite alone when we ask ourselves what really matters. We find ourselves alone, and these voices of the herd, the Eder, the crowd saying, we know what matters, success, da 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 da. And it's quite hard to stand alone there. So we need sangha, we need teachings, we need our books, we need friends, spiritual friends, we need our journeys to India, we need time off to reflect, we need a retreat, we need these things. We need initiation. Initiation can be quite important. You know the word initiation? In Chanicha. Chanicha, the back there, in case you're not, doesn't know. It's initiation. It's a step that that makes some change in us, that shakes our ground, and then it's a little easier to stand against the crowd. It can be many things. This retreat for some people can be initiation. They surrender, something happens, and say, something has changed with me. Now I'm, you know, I was here, now I'm here. May not be great. Initiation doesn't have to be dramatic, huge. But now I'm here, so when I go there, I'm far away. I'm in another place. But it, you need that, you know. And when we travel the path, we also should be aware, and just a few words about this, and I did mention it in the first day, that the path can be also a form of attachment. We can get very attached to a path, to the step by step, to what the Buddha said, and then we feel we can measure ourselves, and we're doing well, we're not doing well, we did what the teacher said we didn't do, we got there, we didn't get there. All the measuring, the criticism, that's a risk from attachment to path. When anyone says to me, and there's certain meditation retreats where when you go in there they say, Bahatzlacha. Bahatzlacha. Good luck. I hope you get it. And it makes my flesh that's not the way you go into meditation retreat. Bahatzlacha, I hope you get it. It's the wrong direction. It's not that. So we can get too attached to path. Path can make us, we can get lost in the stages, and there's 16 stages. I've been sitting 30 years, and I once went to a retreat, and of course in this retreat the teacher, in this particular retreat, it sees you every day and checks your experiences. And he was desperately trying to fit my experiences into the stages that he had in his book, which were really based on beginner's stages. This comes then, this comes then, this comes, and this comes, and this comes. But I've been sitting a lot, many, many years, so nothing that I experienced fit his categories. But he really tried, and he put them all in. He said, oh yes, you're experiencing that. Of course I wasn't experiencing that. But the book, the rule book, was number one. And there's huge text, medieval text, the Visuddhimagga, there's many, many texts that actually go into very fine detail about path. And there's a lot of wisdom. If you read these texts or you get close to them, there's huge wisdom in them, but also a huge risk or danger of getting stuck in path also your whole life. I want another stage, the next stage, when is it, when will it come, I must get it, then the next stage. And you're busy on this thing, it's a bit like the hamster all over again. But the opposite is also a problem, too little path, and you can get lost, just don't know where you are. And that's why, for me anyway, the Dharma is so special, because it really combines. It has in it both path and pathlessness, path and no path. And it's beautiful that you can climb the mountain on a real spiritual journey. You climb the mountain, but there is endless invitation to stop and sit under trees on the way and just be. Climb the mountain, cut your path up the mountain. But then as soon as you look at the flowers by the side of the path, you're not on any path at all. You're in the present moment, which is beyond time, beyond path, beyond all of this. So a non-dual moment, you stop on the path and you see the flowers and you're totally there, then there is no path, there is no time, there's nowhere to go, there's nowhere to come from. It's right there, just there. So path and pathlessness need in some way to be woven together in a very wise way, And for me anyway, at least, the Dharma does that. We have to be careful about path and identity. You will notice that we don't ask you to wear white clothes. We don't ask you to wear any uniform. No one of us teachers are wearing any special, apart from our love, maybe love for India. So we tend to wear kurtas, most of us. But apart from the love for India, you won't find us wearing Buddhist uniform. And if we were monks, for sure we would, because that's a tradition. But we have to be careful of identity. I am quite sad sometimes where people, for a hunger for spirituality, and they go to Jose Bachuba. And there's nothing inherently bad about that, but it's 90% of the time one gets caught in a very heavy identity through an extreme path, and the clothes, and the this, and the uniform, and identity. I am this, and I'm that, and I'm this, and I'm that, and I'm not that, and I must be this. And you get closed in an identity in the name of path. And so many teachers do this, and so many ashrams and paths, you know, they demand from people belong and wear the uniform and become, and there's identity. Well, surely what we're doing is actually undoing, in a sense, identity, replacing the self with something much, much bigger, allowing the bigness. That's what a spiritual path is. Not the smallness of being an identity in a uniform and thinking in a uniform. So we have to be careful about things like this in our journey. It's sometimes very subtle, almost invisible. One says it takes a Buddha to notice another Buddha. Not because of his uniform. In other words, maybe invisible. We don't shout. We don't have another identity who's shouting, "I'm a Buddhist." Most people in my village in Klil really have no idea that I'm doing this. Maybe, oh, Stephen, he lives up on the hill and he's something to do maybe with Vipassana, I'm not sure. Nobody really knows. I don't make a story about it. If someone asks me, I tell them. But most people in the village, there's 400 people in Klil, and almost none of them know what I'm doing. They're just never asked. I don't wear the uniform, so. So something about the path is about, in a way, reducing our self, our identity, our bigness, our self-importance, not making ourselves more important. There is an Indian story about that spiritual path is ants eating the sugar. So I'm sure all of you think, well, obviously the spiritual path is the sugar, and we are the ants eating the sweet, joyful sweetness of spiritual practice, meditation, happiness. No, the other way around. We are the sugar, and the spiritual path eats us until we're all gone. So I want to finish with just a few words. We don't need to choose necessarily the Dharma. This is not the purpose of this talk, is not to try and be a missionary and make everybody Dharma. But it is to describe and define what an authentic spiritual path looks like. And it can be something else. For me, the Dharma is fine, is like good enough. I mean, I don't need anything else. I've been through many, but this the wisdom of it is huge, and I'm fine there. But there's many others, and you can find your own. But I do want to say that although we need a path, otherwise we get swept away by the mind of the herd, the TV mind. We need to have some basic rules about a spiritual path, and I just want to mention a few of them as a kind of caution for you. Firstly, a spiritual path has to not abuse people. No abuse whatsoever. So often teachers or paths make people small and say, because you have to be made small in order for you to discover or to grow. It's not true. You don't need to be made small. We're all big people. We need to be made big. We need to increase our potential in this world. Teachers should not abuse anybody. Spiritual teachers should not take money, should not accumulate wealth, should not use people up or abuse them. That's the first thing. Secondly, there should be a sense of freedom and not a sense of imprisonment, as there are in cults, cuts, you know, it happens. Even Buddhist, in the name of Buddhist centers, it's possible to find this. And by freedom I also mean exclusivity. No true, authentic spiritual teacher would say, only I have the truth. You don't go anywhere else because it's only me. It's only us. It's only this one. And you mustn't go anywhere else. You're not allowed to go anywhere else, otherwise you get cut off, or you get this, you get that, punished. And the main thing is ethics. And we talked about this at the beginning, the precepts, its foundation. The foundation is the precepts, the ethics, ethical sensitivity. And it has to be so deeply ingrained into the spiritual path. Otherwise everything gets terribly distorted and harmful. So, final word, that all this talk about path and so on, but we should remember, it's just a sort of, just something to remember. As we go out into the world, the sun always shines. The clouds can cover it, but the sun doesn't stop shining. So at the back of all our intention and so on, we ought to feel the sun is always shining. In other words, it's always possible. There's always a kind of deeper reality. The nisgav, is it? The sublime is there. It can never be taken away. So all our path to it, or we should remember that it's there for us. Never to be taken away, never changing. They may be covered by clouds, we might not see it, but that's behind all of this journey. Thank you. It'll take a few minutes. bell ringer could ring in 15 minutes, and then come back for the final meditation of the day.
Thank you.